Usually when we talk about who controls the digital world, there's this default expectation of permanent empires.
Right. Yeah. Like the hierarchy is just locked in.
Exactly. It's like we view the internet as being built on digital concrete. A mega corporation builds a massive platform, they lock everyone in, and they just, well, they rule the landscape forever.
It definitely projects that image. I mean, we're all kind of conditioned to think the tech world is a settled debate, like the same five or six giants hold the keys, and that's that.
But then you actually look at what the builders like, the developers on the ground, what they're doing right now, today, and suddenly that concrete looks, I don't know, a lot like sand.
Yeah, it's shifting fast, real fast.
Which is exactly why we're doing this deep dive. So welcome. We're looking at a stack of sources today, mostly pulls from the May 14th, 2026 edition of the Tech and AI Daily Newsletter. And our mission for you, listening right now, is to unpack this massive underlying theme connecting all these stories.
Which is really about the shifting tides of power, right? Power, trust, and control.
Yes, exactly.
It's such a brilliant lens to view this through
Yeah.
because, tech news usually gets fed to us as these isolated updates, like, oh, a new startup here or a security patch over there.
Right, just totally disconnected.
Totally disconnected. But today's sources actually map out a really clear causal chain. I mean, we are watching the friction between centralized corporate control and developer independence basically reach a boiling point.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the absolute macro picture, the geopolitical layer. Because the Stanford 2026 AI Index just dropped, and the headline number is genuinely startling.
That was huge.
Right. The United States' lead over China in AI development has shrunk to a razor-thin 2.7% margin.
Yeah. And just to be precise on that, the index is specifically comparing the top model from Anthropic, which is, one of the leading American AI labs right now, against China's most advanced model.
That 2.7% metric is just, it's wild. It fundamentally alters how we understand what a technological moat actually is.
Exactly. Because a moat is supposed to be this massive barrier to entry. It protects a business or a nation. And for the last few years, the assumption was just that the sheer cost of AI would protect the US.
Right, like the billions of dollars in specialized computer chips, the data centers.
Yeah, that it created an uncrossable moat, but clearly it didn't.
I look at this a bit like the invention gunpowder. You could be the first empire to discover the chemical formula,
Yeah.
right? And you build the biggest gunpowder factories in the world to get that early dominance.
Sure.
But eventually, the underlying chemistry, or well, in this case, the underlying math, it just becomes democratized. The formula gets out.
Right, you can't keep a lid on calculus forever.
Exactly. So that initial moat just completely evaporates.
That's the exact mechanism at play here. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it proves that sheer raw technological supremacy it's incredibly fleeting. The fundamental algorithms powering these models, they're published in research papers. I mean, the mechanics of neural networks, the matrix multiplication, none of it is magic. It's just globally understood mathematics.
But I have to push back a little here because knowing the math is one thing, right? Running the models requires massive physical infrastructure. Doesn't the US still maintain dominance in, like, commercializing that AI,
Oh, totally.
packaging it into enterprise software, and actually selling it to Fortune 500 companies?
Yes, absolutely. The US still has a massive lead in that commercialization pipeline. But the closing 2.7% capability gap is what matters for the future.
Right.
It tells us that no single entity, and really no single nation, can hold a monopoly on the raw intelligence engine of the future. The infrastructure scales, the math spreads, and the whole playing field just levels out.
So what does this all mean for the tech giants then? Because if global superpowers with infinite budgets can't maintain centralized dominance over AI, what makes companies like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft think they can maintain absolute dominance over the internet?
Well, they're starting to realize they might not be able to, which brings us to this massive shift in developer behavior.
The migration.
Yeah, the ground level rebellion against the mega clouds.
Exactly. And look at these two trending discussions from Hacker News. First, there's this highly detailed guide. It was sitting at like 769 upvotes, literally walking developers through the mechanics of migrating an entire digital infrastructure away from AWS, Google, and US-based services.
Moving everything to European alternatives.
Yeah. And right next to it, another post with 456 upvotes documenting a company's full migration away from Microsoft's GitHub over to an open source platform called Forgeo.
And for context for you listening, Forgeo is a self-hosted repository, meaning you run the code hosting software on your own servers rather than relying on Microsoft's servers.
Right. But are these just, you know, isolated acts of open source idealism? Or are we looking at a real systemic rebellion against U.S. mega clouds?
I think it's highly systemic. This is a critical pivot. Platforms like GitHub are quietly bleeding trust in open source circles.
Bleeding trust.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's not just a few vocal purists acting out. This is a practical push toward digital sovereignty.
Okay, let's break down that term, digital sovereignty.
Yeah.
In practical terms, what are these developers actually trying to achieve?
It's the need for builders to own the land their digital house sits on, rather than renting it from an unpredictable giant.
Okay, yeah.
When you build your entire company's workflow on AWS or GitHub, you are entirely at the mercy of their corporate structuring. I mean, if they change their pricing models tomorrow or alter their terms of service, your business can just break overnight.
So digital sovereignty is the attempt to reclaim that ultimate control.
Exactly. Over your own infrastructure.
And we actually have a perfect visceral example of those rules changing abruptly in our sources today. The Kickstarter story.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge one.
According to a report from Kotaku, Visa and MasterCard effectively forced the crowdfunding platform Kickstarter to ban adult content. Now, keeping this strictly focused on the mechanism here, the actual content of the ban aside, the underlying mechanics of how this happened is wild.
It really is.
The source points out that payment processors are acting as the internet's most powerful unelected regulators, operating with literally zero democratic accountability.
And this perfectly illustrates exactly why developers are seeking sovereignty. Think about the mechanics of what just happened there. You have a platform Kickstarter with its own community and its own rules.
Right.
But a payment network, which is just the financial plumbing beneath the platform, can dictate the acceptable use policy simply by threatening to turn off the ability to process credit cards.
It's a chokehold. I mean, it literally doesn't matter what your platform's rules are if the plumbing gets shut off.
Precisely. No laws were passed, no government intervened. The infrastructure providers simply realized they have the ultimate leverage and, well, they used it.
So when developers see that?
They respond by packing up. They move to systems they can control. European alternatives with stricter data privacy laws or self-hosted options like Forjejo, where there is literally no external corporate entity that can just flip a switch and turn off their code repository.
It is a totally logical reaction. But, and here's the massive catch, sovereignty. Sounds amazing, until you realize that if you own the castle, you also have to be the chief security officer.
Oh, yeah. That is the painful reality.
Right. When you migrate away from these massive centralized systems that have thousands of security engineers, and you start managing your own stack, things inevitably break.
Yes. The double-edged sword of owning your own infrastructure. You gain control, but you absorb all the risk.
Which leads us directly into the terrifying realities of system fragility. Let's look at the GitHub Action Security Advisory from our stack today.
The Composer leak.
Yeah. Composer, which is the default package manager for the PHP programming language, revealed that GitHub Actions could accidentally leak GitHub token values directly into workflow logs. Let's explain how this actually happens mechanically.
Right. So a GitHub token is basically an automated digital key. When developers write code, they use automated pipelines, often called CI, or continuous integration, to test and build that code. The token is the key that gives that automated pipelines permission to read or modify the code repository.
And what Composer found was that under certain conditions, if an error occurred, the system would dump its environmental variables, which included that highly sensitive digital key, straight into a plain text log file.
Which is terrifying.
Anyone who could read that text file could just copy the key and hijack the entire project.
Just walk right in.
Exactly. Now, contrast that highly technical automated flaw with this Ars Technica story about two IT worker twin brothers.
Oh my God, the twins. The story is just wild.
It's nuts. These twin brothers, immediately after being fired, rage deleted 96 government databases.
It's a staggering story, almost cinematic in its chaos.
But the parallel is what's so interesting to me.
Yeah.
The Composer leak is like accidentally leaving the master key to the building visible on the security camera footage, right?
Yeah, a technical oversight.
Exactly, a flaw in the automated pipeline.
Yeah.
But the twin brothers story, that's like firing the security guard but forgetting to actually ask for his keys back as he walks out the door.
What's fascinating here is how both of these incidents, you know, despite being vastly different in their scale and their origin, one being a line of bad code, the other being human rage, they represent the exact same fundamental failure in system architecture.
The boundary verification?
Exactly. They both failed at least privilege access.
Walk me through the mechanics of that failure, because an automated token leak feels very different from angry twins.
Well, it comes down to what the system is instructed to trust. In the GitHub Actions leak, an automated system was given a token with broad permissions, and those permissions weren't properly sanitized when an error occurred.
So it just dumped everything.
Right. The logging mechanism blindly trusted that whatever it was outputting was safe to display. Now, in the case of the government databases, human resources officially terminated the employees, but the IT infrastructure's offboarding mechanics failed.
So the system still trusted their digital credentials.
Exactly. The technical boundaries didn't update to match the real-world boundaries. If the brothers had been restricted by least privilege access, meaning they only had the exact minimum permissions needed to do their specific daily tasks,
they wouldn't have possessed the overarching administrative rights to wipe 96 databases simultaneously.
Exactly. And if the offboarding architecture was automated to instantly revoke all credentials the millisecond HR hit terminate, their anger wouldn't have translated to catastrophic data loss.
Oh.
Whether you are dealing with a poorly written script or a disgruntled human, if your infrastructure relies on blind trust rather than cryptographically verified constraints, it is incredibly fragile.
And navigating that fragility is just exhausting.
Yeah.
Dealing with leaky tokens, self-hosting code repositories, trying to migrate away from centralized monopolies, constantly auditing who has access to what database. I mean, just reading the list makes me tired.
It's an immense cognitive load. The human toll of maintaining the digital world is very real.
And all of this friction leads straight to developer burnout, which is a massive theme in our next set of sources.
Yeah, we had this new initiative trending called the open source resistance.
Right. It's a grassroots push demanding that employers pay for the time developers spend contributing to open source projects. And it is landing right at this exact moment when trust in big tech is eroding and developers are feeling the squeeze of having to maintain all this infrastructure themselves.
It's a highly necessary cultural pushback. I mean, if open source software is the foundation powering the entire corporate internet, which it absolutely is, then the corporations extracting billions of dollars in value from that foundation should pay for its maintenance. Currently, they're relying on developers doing it for free on their weekends out of sheer passion.
Which is a complete recipe for catastrophic burnout.
Absolutely.
And to prevent that burnout, we are seeing a massive evolution in developer tooling. Laurent Lebrun just published a fascinating history of IDEs, integrated development environments, basically the software developers used to write software during his time at Google.
Yeah, that was a great read.
He traces the evolution all the way from the ancient hyper-minimalist text editors like V and Emacs to Google eventually having to build massive cloud-based internal infrastructure just to handle their own code, creating tools like CDC and Cider.
Which really demonstrates a fundamental truth about scale. Google realized early on that when a code base reaches millions of lines of code, you can't just hand a developer a laptop and expect them to hold the entire architecture in their head.
Right.
The complexity of the tool has to scale to manage the complexity of the code. Otherwise, development just grinds to a halt.
Which brings us to a really elegant modern solution highlighted in the newsletter, a YC startup from the Spring 2026 batch called Ardent. They are building a tool that allows developers to spin up fully isolated Postgres databases, entirely sandboxed in seconds with zero migrations. And the goal is to totally solve the nightmare of the shared database in CI.
For anyone listening who hasn't had the distinct displeasure of working with a shared development database, let me explain the mechanics of why it's such a nightmare.
Please do.
Imagine a professional kitchen where 10 chefs are forced to cook 10 entirely different meals in the exact same pot at the exact same time.
Right, total chaos.
That pot is a shared database.
Yeah.
Every time one developer changes a schema, which is basically the structural blueprint of how the data tables are organized, it instantly breaks the code of the other 9 developers who are relying on the old blueprint.
And Ardent solves this mechanically by sandboxing. They essentially give every single chef their own magical temporary pot that perfectly mirrors the master pot, but instantly vanishes when they are done cooking.
Exactly. They can change the schema, run their automated tests, and throw it away without ever stepping on a coworker's toes.
But here's where it gets really interesting to me. Think about the stark dichotomy of what we're talking about today.
How do you mean?
On one hand, we started this deep dive talking about AI models, closing geopolitical gaps, simulating human reasoning, and processing billions of parameters. Mm. We are touching science fiction.
Yeah, the bleeding edge.
Yet, on the other hand, the human developers building these systems are still losing their minds fighting over shared development databases just so they can run a basic code test without wiping out their coworkers' staging environment. It's kind of absurd.
It is a brilliant juxtaposition, and I think it synthesizes these points perfectly. Look at the common thread. Why did Google spend millions building massive cloud-based text editors?
Right.
Why is Ardent building instantly disposable sandbox databases? Why is the open source resistance demanding paid maintenance time? The core lesson here is that modern developer tooling isn't actually about writing code faster.
What is the true function of the tooling then?
It is entirely about protecting human attention. It's about preserving mental bandwidth. Every single time a developer has to untangle a shared database schema, or manually revoke an ex-employee's token, or work unpaid weekend hours to patch a critical open source vulnerability.
You're draining the tank.
Exactly. You are draining the cognitive resources required to actually invent the future. Good tooling is essentially a psychological defense mechanism against organizational friction.
A psychological defense mechanism. I love that framing. And honestly, despite all that friction, despite the burnout, the fragile security perimeters, and the heavy hand of corporate monopolies acting as unelected regulators, open source engineering continues to produce these beautiful, entirely unexpected triumphs.
The resilience of open systems is really remarkable. When you remove the walled gardens, it allows for a level of emergent, bottom-up innovation that rigid, top-down corporate structures simply cannot anticipate.
And I have the perfect example of that from today's stack, the XDA Developers Report. Linux gaming is getting significantly faster. But how it's getting faster is the crazy part. It's because Windows APIs have matured so much that the functionality is actually being absorbed directly into the Linux kernel itself. Let's break down the mechanics of this because it's wild.
We should probably first clarify what an API is in this context.
Good idea.
An application programming interface is essentially the messenger or the bridge that allows a piece of software, like a video game, to talk to the computer's hardware, like the graphics card. Windows has its own proprietary APIs like DirectX.
Right. And historically, if you wanted to play a Windows game on the open-source Linux operating system, you had to use compatibility layers tools with names like DXVK and Wine.
Yeah.
And these tools acted as real-time translators, frantically intercepting the game's Windows API calls and translating them into Linux-friendly instructions, like Vulkan.
Which is an incredibly complex engineering feat. But traditionally, that real-time translation caused overhead. It made the games run slower or glitch.
But the developers of these open source translation layers just kept refining the code day after day, year after year. And according to XDA, it has gotten so hyper-optimized that they are mapping these instructions so efficiently, they are bypassing the overhead entirely.
It's incredible.
The translation layer is functioning so well, it's effectively becoming part of the foundation. I just want you, listening right now, to think about the sheer irony of this. Microsoft's own proprietary protocols are effectively being reverse engineered and optimized to improve gaming performance on a competing open source Linux operating system.
It is the ultimate peak 2026 plot twist.
It really is.
It really is a phenomenal achievement. It highlights how open source doesn't just survive alongside proprietary tech. It actively dissects it, learns from it, and integrates the best parts.
And it's not just Linux gaming. The newsletter also noted that Haiku OS is trending again.
Oh, Haiku. Yeah.
This is an open source operating system completely built from scratch, inspired by the old BIOS from the 90s. You aren't going to run it as your daily driver to check your email or run enterprise software, but it has a highly active, beautifully engineered code base. It is a pure, passion-driven development.
And I think that brings our thematic journey full circle. When you look at projects like Haiku OS or the Linux kernel seamlessly absorbing Windows functionality, it proves that passionate engineering persists regardless of the environment.
Yeah.
Even when the tech landscape feels entirely dominated by centralized AI models with billion-dollar compute budgets or payment processors dictating the rules of the internet, the open source ecosystem finds a way. Yeah. It adapts, it absorbs the best mechanics of proprietary systems, and it thrives.
Like a root system cracking the concrete sidewalk, you know?
Right.
The monopoly pours the concrete, but the network underneath just keeps growing until it finds the stress points and breaks through.
And eventually the concrete becomes sand again.
Exactly. So, to bring this all home, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started at the highest geopolitical level, exploring the mechanics of how the compute moat between the U.S. and China has shrunk to a mere 2.7% as the math behind AI democratizes.
Right, and we tracked the great developer migration, watching builders actively seek digital sovereignty by moving away from mega clouds like AWS and GitHub towards self-hosted platforms like Forjao.
And then we examined the severe security trade-offs of that sovereignty, dissecting how automated token leaks and CI pipelines and angry IT twins both expose the critical flaw of failing to implement least privilege access.
We looked at the human cost, too. The burnout that led to the open source resistance, and the evolution of tooling from Google's massive text editors to ardent sandbox databases, all designed to protect our cognitive bandwidth.
And finally, we ended with the beautiful irony of Windows APIs being absorbed to power open-source Linux gaming.
A perfect demonstration of the shifting balance of power.
So, for everyone listening, I want you to take a moment today to reflect on your own digital life. Think about the platforms you rely on daily. Who actually controls the underlying infrastructure of your business, your projects, or your creative output?
We've seen today that the tech giants are bleeding trust and that power is decentralizing into the hands of developers building open source alternatives. But I want to leave you with a new question to mull over.
Okay, let's hear it.
If developers are fleeing corporate platforms to build open source tools, what happens when we close that loop with the AI we discussed at the very beginning? What happens in a few years when those corporate AI models are the ones actually writing and maintaining the code for these grassroots open source platforms?
Oh.
When the code itself is generated by a centralized intelligence, who do we trust then? Do we trust the corporation that trained the model, the developer who prompted it, or the algorithm itself?
That is a phenomenal question and a whole new paradigm of trust to worry about. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems you interact with every day. Keep looking beneath the surface to see where the power really lies, and we'll catch you next time.